Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The emergence of the threatening new Omicron variant shows how important it is for the world to end the current cycle of panic and neglect over the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who told a special meeting of the organization's governing body in Geneva on Monday that greater international cooperation is essential to preserve hard-won gains. The World Health Assembly meeting was convened to decide on the issue of a so-called pandemic treaty. An international agreement is needed urgently, said Tedros, who insisted that global health security was too important to be left to chance, goodwill, or shifting geopolitical currents, or the vested interests of companies and shareholders.
Omicron's very emergence is another reminder that although many of us might think we're done with COVID-19, it's not done with us. We're living through a cycle of panic and neglect. Hard-won gains could vanish in an instant. Our most immediate task, therefore, is to end this pandemic.
In his call for a pandemic treaty, WHO's Tedros highlighted unequal COVID vaccine distribution. In less than a year, almost 8 billion vaccines have been administered around the world, Tedros said, making it the largest vaccination campaign in history. But despite warnings by the WHO that the poorest and most vulnerable countries would be trampled in the global stampede for vaccines, more than 80% of jabs have gone to G20 countries. Low-income countries have received just 0.6% of all vaccines, and most of these are nations in Africa, Tedros said. Continued violations of the rights of Palestinian people imperil the chances of them ever living peacefully with Israeli communities, UN Chief Antonio Guterres said on Monday. The Secretary General's message, which comes ahead of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, noted that the unresolved situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, continues to pose a significant challenge to international peace and security. Specifically, Mr. Guterres warned that persistent violations of the rights of Palestinians, along with the expansion of settlements, risk eroding the prospect of a two-state solution. Despite being encouraged by recent engagements between senior officials on both sides, the UN chief said that containing the situation is not sufficient. The coronavirus pandemic will cost the global tourism sector $2 trillion in lost revenue in 2021, the UN's tourism body said on Monday, calling the sector's recovery fragile and slow. According to the latest forecast by the United Nations World Tourism Organization, the same amount was lost in 2020, making it one of the sectors hit hardest by the health crisis. Demand for travel could be further affected by uneven vaccination rates and new COVID-19 strains, such as the new Omicron variant, which has caused dozens of countries to bring in new restrictions in recent days. Spikes in oil prices and the disruption of global supply chains have also had a negative effect. Although a 58% increase in tourist arrivals was registered in July to September of this year compared to the same period in 2020, this remained 64% below 2019 levels, the UN body noted. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Health Organization's warning the Omicron coronavirus variant poses a very high risk to nations and could set off new waves of infections, especially in areas with low vaccination rates. On Monday, World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus thanked leaders in Southern Africa for sounding the alarm over the new variant and called for a global treaty to prevent, prepare for, and respond to future pandemics.
South Africa and Botswana should be thanked for detecting, sequencing, and reporting this variant not penalized. Indeed, Omicron demonstrates just why the world needs a new accord on pandemics. Our current system disincentivizes countries from alerting others to threats that will inevitably land on their shores.
The World Health Organization has criticized travel bans against Southern Africa. On Monday, more than 2 million nurses from 28 countries filed a complaint with the United Nations demanding an investigation into wealthy countries that have blocked a proposed patent waiver for COVID-19 vaccines. The nurses accused the governments of protecting the profits of big pharmaceutical companies at the expense of public health. Meanwhile, Chinese President Xi Jinping has pledged to deliver 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines to Africa, on top of the nearly 200 million doses China has already supplied. Only about 10% of Africans have received one vaccine dose, compared with 64% in North America. Here in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control has strengthened its recommendations to say all U.S. adults should get a vaccine booster shot. Meanwhile, Pfizer said it'll ask regulators this week to approve booster shots for 16 and 17-year-olds. At the White House, President Biden said the Omicron variant has cause for concern, not panic. He said the White House would work with drug companies to reformulate vaccines to be more effective against the Omicron variant.
So that we are prepared, if needed, my team is already working with officials at Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson to develop contingency plans for vaccines or boosters if needed.
A federal court in Missouri has temporarily blocked President Biden's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers in 10 states. District Judge Matthew Shelp, a Trump appointee, ruled legal challenges to the mandate are likely to succeed because Congress has not granted the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services the power to enforce a vaccine mandate. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Monday the Pentagon has opened a high-level inquiry into the U.S. airstrike that killed dozens of women and children near the Syrian town of Bahuz in March of 2019. This comes after a New York Times investigation found the military spent 2.5 years covering up the attack, even though the death toll was almost immediately apparent to military officials, with one legal officer flagging the attack as a possible war crime. U.S. military officials downplayed the death toll, delayed reports, and sanitized and classified evidence of civilian deaths. U.S.-led coalition forces bulldozed the blast site, and top military leaders were reportedly not notified. Iran's resumed talks in Vienna, Austria, aimed at restoring the 2015 nuclear deal after former President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the multilateral agreement in 2018 while imposing harsh economic sanctions on Iran. On Monday, Iran's top negotiator called the sanctions tyrannical, unlawful, and cruel, insisting Iran will never agree to a new deal unless the Biden administration first lifts the sanctions. An Australian government commission has revealed shocking details about Australia's federal parliament, describing it as a toxic workplace rife with gender inequality, bullying, and sexual harassment and assault. The investigation was opened earlier this year amidst allegations of sexual assault and rape inside the parliament building. On Monday, Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins announced her team's findings.
Over half, that is 51% of all people currently in Commonwealth parliamentary workplaces, have experienced at least one incident of bullying, sexual harassment, or actual or attempted sexual assault. Women we spoke to told us they felt lucky when they had not directly experienced sexual harassment or sexual assault.
Here in New York, opening statements began Monday in the federal sex trafficking trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, the British socialite who is accused of luring economically disadvantaged girls to be sexually abused by convicted predator and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Prosecutor Laura Pomerantz told the jurors starting in the 90s, Maxwell would recruit girls for Epstein to sexually abuse, telling the girls they had been hired to give massages. Pomerantz argued Epstein and Maxwell then devised a pyramid scheme of abuse and said the two were partners in crime. At least four women who were sexually abused as children by Epstein will be testifying during the trial, including a survivor who was 14 at the time. Maxwell faces up to 70 years in prison if convicted of all counts, including sex trafficking a minor. Epstein died in a Manhattan jail in 2019. New York's medical examiner ruled his death a suicide. CNN's announced it'll review newly released information that details how anchor Chris Cuomo helped his brother, the disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, strategize a defense against mounting accusations of sexual harassment. Thousands of pages of new evidence and sworn testimony were released Monday showing Andrew Cuomo, who was found to have sexually harassed at least 11 women, heavily relied on his allies, including his younger brother, to manipulate the press and discredit his accusers. Documents include text messages between Chris Cuomo and Melissa DeRosa, a former top aide to Governor Cuomo, suggesting the CNN anchor was instrumental in crafting his brother's defense strategy. Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and other Democratic lawmakers are calling on Republican leaders to hold Colorado Republican Congressmember Lauren Boebert accountable for recent hateful and Islamophobic comments. So far, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has refused the request. In a video posted to Twitter last week that's since gone viral, Boebert called Omar one of the first Muslim women elected to Congress, a member of the Jihad Squad, and joked she was a suicide bomber. On Monday, Congresswoman Omar confirmed she abruptly ended a phone call with Boebert after Boebert refused to publicly apologize for her remarks. Omar tweeted, quote, "There is only so much grace we can extend to others as humans before we must learn to cut our losses or hang up on someone in this case." The National Labor Relations Board has ruled Amazon violated U.S. labor laws that fought a unionization campaign by warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama, earlier this year. The ruling sets the stage for a new union election sometime in the next several months. More than 70% of Amazon workers who cast ballots in the union election in February voted against joining the retail, wholesale, and department store union. The union says the vote failed after an aggressive campaign of intimidation, interference, and surveillance by Amazon managers. On Monday, the NLRB agreed, ruling that Amazon worked illegally with the U.S. Postal Service to install a collection box at the warehouse one day before the voting was set to begin. Amazon managers then pressured workers to drop their ballots in the new collection box, casting doubt over the secrecy of the election. Trailblazing black former Congresswoman Carrie Meek died Sunday in her home in Miami. She was 95 years old. Born in Tallahassee, Meek was the daughter of a sharecropper and granddaughter of an enslaved woman. In 1993, Carrie Meek joined the U.S. House as one of the first black Floridians elected to Congress since the Reconstruction era. She championed affirmative action, economic opportunities for low-income people, and advocated for the U.S. to ease its restrictions of migrants from Haiti, where many of her constituents were from. Immigrant justice advocates are denouncing brutal and dangerous conditions faced by Haitian asylum seekers currently imprisoned at the Torrance County Detention Facility in Estancia, New Mexico. At least 50 asylum seekers who were previously sheltering under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, were taken to Torrance shortly after Border Patrol violently apprehended thousands of asylum seekers in September. Most have been deported by the Biden administration. Advocates are demanding Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, allow pro bono lawyers provide the Haitian asylum seekers with in-person legal consultations at Torrance, that information about legal services be posted at the facility in Haitian Creole, and that ICE halt deportations and asylum seekers are released while their cases are resolved. The asylum seekers have also detailed mistreatment and medical neglect at Torrance, which is operated by the private prison corporation CoreCivic. In Bolivia, thousands of labor and indigenous leaders marched in La Paz Monday in support of socialist President Luis Arce, warning the world they would not allow another coup. The march for the homeland was led by former Bolivian President Evo Morales, who was overthrown in November 2019 following a U.S.-backed right-wing military coup. This is President Luis Arce.
Hermanos. Brothers, this is not the end. This is the beginning, because the people have come to defend their vote. They came to defend democracy, but they also came to tell those right-wing coup plotters there will never be coups in our country.
And Barbados has officially removed Queen Elizabeth as its head of state, freeing itself from the British monarchy after nearly 400 years of colonization. In an overnight ceremony in the capital, Bridgetown, Dame Sandra Mason was sworn in as Barbados's first ever president.
And with firm resolve and in one voice, from this day and forever, declare Barbados parliamentary republic.
Fireworks adorned the sky at midnight as Barbados officially became the world's newest nation. Ahead of the ceremony, Barbados held a national service of thanksgiving where Barbados Senator and Reverend John Rogers spoke.
Our seed is one that survived the journey that many should not have survived. Survived 300 years of a plantation system that many should not have survived. Every child born in this country is a gift of God, specially preserved, specially protected.
Prince Charles joined Monday evening's ceremony where he formally acknowledged Britain's, quote, appalling atrocity of slavery in the Caribbean. The Barbadian singer, actress, and fashion designer Rihanna also attended the ceremony where she was declared a national hero by Barbados's prime minister. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Good afternoon, you, my fellow miscreants, degenerates, and knuckleheads in Kansas. I'm not so sure it's a good day or not. That was Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! That's an hour-long program. That's just the first 10-15 minutes of headline world news I just gave you. Goodman's Democracy Now! Also appears as, or the full hour, comes on over the air, channel 19.2, I believe it is, 19.2, comes over the air, the local PBS affiliate. Oh, damn, the call letters don't come to me right now. At 8 o'clock in the morning, if you're missed the 7 in the morning broadcast, there's a full hour on your FM radio. So you can be driving in your car, commuting to your slave job, and tune in at 8 a.m. at KKFI 90.1 FM, which also has a live stream, so you can listen to it. The full hour of Democracy Now! While driving, or excuse me, while cruising on your computer. Or your cell phone, I guess. You can do it with your cell phone. Second hour coming up, you know, well, actually, coming up right now is Counterspin from FAIR.org. Fair. Presented by Janine Jackson. Counterspin gives you the news behind the headlines. They give you a little bit angle. I'm giving you the best you can get in 1 hour on a Tuesday. Because it is happening, baby. It's happening. Oh, yeah, it's happening. John Grant, live, taking calls. Get your pencils out, 646-716-8652. In the second hour, we'll be taking callers. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. I'm your producer. Ha, 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 fellow knuckleheads. Let's move on to Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, what do we want? Multiracial democracy. When do we want it? Now. What stands in the way? White supremacy that has disregarded, derailed, and violently defied that democracy at multiple important turns. Those anguished over the Rittenhouse acquittal, depressed by racist police brutality, unnerved by the failure to take the January 6th insurrection seriously, and worried about systemic predations on voting rights, are sometimes led to say, "This isn't America." If you attend to actual U.S. history, importantly different from what you might have read in your history textbook, or what you might someday be allowed to read in your history textbook, you will understand that this is America. But that still doesn't mean that it has to be. This can be a turning point in U.S. history if we don't sit down and shut up, and if more of us understand that history isn't something that happens to us or around us, but something we do. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, and One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. We'll talk with her about her recent Guardian column on the historical and ongoing struggle between white supremacy and the U.S.'s hopes for democracy. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. When a news outlet hosts a roundtable on affirmative action featuring only white men, or a debate on abortion including only people who won't become pregnant, the bias is pretty clear. But many of corporate media's ways of telling you to think one thing but not another are more subtle and insinuating, and especially effective if they're talking about a place you don't know much about. On November 19th, farmers in India and their global supporters celebrated the announcement by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi of the repeal of three agricultural laws that farmers and allies have been protesting vehemently and at great cost for more than a year. Some 250 million people took to the streets across India last December against policies of Modi's right-wing Hindu nationalist government and three laws in particular that deregulated the agricultural sector. The government said the laws aimed to give farmers, quote, the freedom to sell directly to institutional buyers, close quote, unshackling them, they said, to get better prices. But opposition parties and others called out that the new rules would make small farmers vulnerable to competition from big business, result in their losing price support on key staples, and generally diminish farmers' bargaining power. India's agricultural sector sustains some 58% of the country's people, and farmers found many allies in their resistance. But that didn't mean that the months of action didn't take a tremendous toll, including as many as 750 protesters who died in harsh protest camp conditions. Which brings us to the New York Times reporting on the repeal of the laws under protest. Quote, in rare show of weakness, Modi bows to India's farmers, close quote, was the paper's November 20th headline. FAIR's Julie Holler suggested on Twitter that when a nominally Democratic government addresses widespread and sustained public demands, some folks would call that something positive, like responsiveness rather than weakness. Reporters don't write headlines, as we often note, but this piece delivered multiple linguistic tells. COVID and the struggling economy left Modi's party, quote, vulnerable to a well-organized protest movement, close quote, the subhead explained. So don't focus on the wrongness of the laws, but other externals as crucial. And then for those who know elite media, well-organized is a bit of a wink toward the idea that an honest protest would consist of atomized individuals. Organization is a bit suspicious. The laws Modi says will be repealed, we're told early on, were, quote, aimed at fixing the country's struggling agricultural sector, close quote. Well, who doesn't want to fix something that's struggling? There is a single paragraph tucked in about how one of the governing party's convoys rammed into a group of protesting farmers, resulting in the deaths of, that's media speak for killing, four of them, along with four others, including a journalist. And then late in the piece, an academic source suggests that the success of protests is good news for India's democracy. It isn't that you can't learn, in this case about Indian farmers' protests, from reading a story like this. It's just always worth considering whether you're taking away something more than information. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Those sifting for signs of critical weakness in the prosecution argument in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial are missing the forest for the trees. We ask the law to deliver us from injustice, but remember why people were protesting in Kenosha, Wisconsin in the first place, to protest the inadequacy of U.S. systems and institutions to protect or to value black life. The head-spinning outrage of this case, from police thanking Rittenhouse for roaming around with an illegal assault rifle up through his acquittal of the murders he committed, may make it seem that what we used to quaintly call race relations have gone to a whole other level. But it's important to remember that the roots of these events, along with other things we see happening, are entwined deeply throughout this country's history. And as our guest's work reminds us, we aren't just talking about the relationship between black and white Americans. We're talking about the relationship between Americans and democracy. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, and One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. She joins us now by phone from Atlanta. Welcome back to Counterspin, Carol Anderson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've been hearing the term turning point, and I want to believe it, but if we are to be at a turning point, seeing where we've been can show us what we need to do and what will be insufficient. And that's why I wanted to talk about your most recent piece for The Guardian, whose headline really encapsulates the lesson, "White Supremacists Declare War on Democracy and Walk Away Unscathed." You're talking, yes, about the January 6th insurrection and the response to that, but you talk about it as an echo of actions and responses going really all the way back to the beginning of the country.
Absolutely. And what struck me, and this really began to come out for me as I was working on my latest book, the second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America, was the way that white supremacists were willing to hold the United States of America hostage in order to advance their white supremacist ideology in order to embed it into the bedrock foundation of this nation, and that they were willing to destroy the United States if they didn't get their way. And for that, they should have been held accountable. But instead, they were revered. Instead, they were allowed to walk away. And that lack of accountability over and over and over only emboldens the white supremacists and puts the United States of America and its ideas and this democracy at risk.
Well, you talk about how even during the War of Independence, you know, we're talking about South Carolina. Take us back to that, because I don't believe that people think, yes, I remember the Civil War, but it goes before that.
It goes before that. And so you had the British who said that they were going to hit the soft underbelly of the revolution, which was the South. And the British hit Georgia and just took Savannah, boom, like that. And then they were headed up to South Carolina. And George Washington sent his emissary, his aide-de-camp, down to South Carolina to plead with the government there to arm the enslaved, because South Carolina did not have enough white men to take on that 8,000-strong British force that was coming for the invasion. And South Carolina looked at John Lawrence, and John Lawrence is a son of the South. He is a South Carolinian. And they looked at him, and they were outraged. They talked about how horrified they were. They were absolutely alarmed that he would even suggest this, that this would be coming from Washington. This would be coming from the Continental Congress to try to arm the enslaved just because the British were invading. No way, because the whites had deployed white men to act as the militia to control that enslaved population that the government had defined as the threat. So this is in the middle of a war, and the threat are black people. You know, they began to talk about surrendering to the British, you know, and trying to declare their neutrality in this war, just so they would not have to arm the enslaved. And so think about that. They were willing to walk away from the United States of America, the thing that folks have been fighting for, the thing that folks have been dying for, just so that they could continue to enslave human beings, enslave black people.
And so it's very meaningful then that after that fact, there was no kind of comeuppance. There was no kind of, you know, you didn't have our back there, you know, you weren't really with us. There was no kind of assessment or real consequences for South Carolina.
No consequences. You know, there was some grumbling, like, oh, and they didn't even fight. But the thing is that they were fully welcomed into the halls of power. They were fully welcomed into the Constitutional Convention, where, again, they flexed their Southern muscles to demand that the bedrock document for the United States of America, the Constitution, would have inordinate power for slaveholders, for the enslavers, and that it would continue to protect slavery. And they kept making clear, we will walk away unless we get what we want. And so you had folks like James Madison, who was the architect of the Constitution, and Rufus King out of Massachusetts, who were beside themselves going, we had to give in because the United States of America was worth it. They were willing to destroy the United States of America unless they got their way. And so their way included 20 additional years of the Atlantic slave trade. It included the Fugitive Slave Clause, and it included the Three-Fifths Clause that added additional congressional representation to the southern states in Congress by counting their enslaved people as three-fifths for population numbers. And it was that Three-Fifths Clause that added an additional 18 to 20 seats to the South in Congress, where they then flexed their muscle again. And for all of that, no consequences.
Can you just take a note about the beating up? You know, we're not talking about just haranguing. We're, you know, what they did to get their way, it would blow minds today.
Yeah, Joanne Freeman wrote a brilliant book, Field of Blood, where she lays out how the South bullied and beat on northern congressional representatives to ensure that language and bills that would try to curtail slavery did not see the light of day. So this led up to with the caning actually of Charles Sumner, where he was beaten on the Senate floor by Preston Brooks out of South Carolina. No consequences.
Right.
And what this does is white supremacy keeps bullying, keeps beating, keeps threatening the viability of the United States of America white supremacy cannot be satisfied, cannot be sated. There's not enough that you can give it to make it go, okay, I'm fine, we're cool.
Right.
Instead, without having consequences for that horrific behavior, it only emboldens. And this is what leads us into the Civil War.
Absolutely. And so I hope that listeners know about the Civil War and the Confederacy, but let's skip, if we would, to the way they were treated. Again, we're talking about repercussions for aggression. We have folks who are so emboldened that they're declaring war on the United States. Then when they lose, again, they get folded back in, right?
Oh. I mean, and so imagine killing over 600,000 American troops, costing the U.S. billions of dollars, trying to get the British and the French to hop into the war to fight against the United States of America. And after the South loses the war, then you have Andrew Johnson as president granting amnesty to the Confederate leaders. And then, because the whole point for Johnson was that this was a war to keep the Union together. And so you don't have the consequences for those who waged war against the United States of America. These are traitors. And instead what happens is that you get not only this folding in of these traitors into the United States of America, but you get then this narrative that comes through in the textbooks, this lost cause, that this war was about Southern heritage, and it was about states' rights. It wasn't about slavery, and that this was the war of Northern aggression, when it was the South that fired on Fort Sumter because Lincoln had won the election, and his platform was that he did not want to see slavery extended out west. Not that he wanted to abolish slavery, but that he didn't want it to have it extended out west. And that's what I mean about white supremacy cannot be sated. White supremacy cannot be sated, and particularly if it does not have to face the consequences of the damage that it does to this nation, to American democracy.
Well, the importance of that narrative being allowed to continue and to grow can't be understated, but I also wanted to note how you point out that folding those Confederates back into the U.S., that was also helped by the Supreme Court undoing decisions that Congress had made, and we're still living with that as well.
Absolutely. So Congress had put in place, the Reconstruction Congress had put in place basically the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments. 13th, abolishing slavery. The 14th, providing for birthright citizenship, due process, and equal protection under the law. And the 15th, providing that no state shall abridge the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Congress also passed acts to ban white domestic terrorism because of the rise of the Klan and the violence that the Klan and its ilk, such as the White Camellia, the Knights of the White Camellia, and the Red Shirts, were raining down on black folk. And so Congress had tried to provide those protections. And you had the U.S. Supreme Court going through in decision after decision and undermining every one of those protections. And what that did was it allowed the rise of that white supremacist regime to go on unchecked and rain down its violence and its discriminatory actions that, again, undermined American democracy. This is where we get the rise of Jim Crow, and this is where we get the rise of lynching.
And it shows that the intertwining of law and this vigilantism, it's not just the narrative of the lost cause and the war of Northern aggression that's been allowed to go unchecked, but we also have these laws, that tell people that somehow the law has their back, and that brings us back to January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, where people are believing that they are supporting something, you know, that believing that they are also continuing some historical thrust. And they have reason to believe that. Yeah. And then also the consequences here. Again, folks may say, this is so surprising. This is an echo of what's happened before.
This is an echo of what happened before, because what this was about at its base was the demonization of voters of color. So you had the Republicans laying out that the election was stolen from Trump in Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Atlanta, Detroit, cities where you have sizable black populations. And so when they say if you only count the legal votes, he won, which meant if you don't count the votes from black folk in the city, he won. And it is that anger that black folks and Asian Americans and Native Americans and Hispanics did not overwhelmingly vote for an avowed white supremacist, that you get this attack on the U.S. Capitol, on American democracy, as Congress is doing its work of certifying the election by counting the electoral votes, and where they're hanging Mike Pence and they're hunting for Nancy Pelosi, as one of the assailants said, they wanted to drag her where her head was hitting every one of the steps coming down out of that Capitol. They saw themselves as patriots. But what they were doing was assaulting American democracy for white supremacy. That should have been stunning enough. But instead, what we get is the January 6th Commission taking months upon months to come into being. And then it's subpoenas being like, who cares about a subpoena?
Right.
Where you're getting the assailants who went into the Capitol, who defecated in there, beat on police officers. We've got the first real sentence of 41 months. But generally you were getting probation. You were getting, you can go on vacation. Wow.
Yeah.
When you don't have consequences for assaulting American democracy, it empowers and it emboldens white supremacy to assault and attack it again.
Well, we think of history as moving. Many people think of history as moving, if not smoothly, still directionally. You know, like we're still sort of stepping towards equality among races, with a few steps back. But part of that narrative is, you don't fight for equality. Equality is about everybody getting along, you know? And so black people being angry is part of the problem. There's this narrative confusion about what it takes to make history, and that somehow history is going to happen even if I don't do anything.
And as Frederick Douglass says, power never concedes anything without a demand. It never has, and it never will. To me, the story of America is that we are an aspirational nation. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That's the aspiration. And you have those who confuse that aspiration with achievement, like we have overcome, when in fact it has been black folk who have been fighting to make that aspiration real. It has been those who have been marginalized in the society, those who have faced the brunt of the worst that white supremacy has to offer, and who believed in America enough to fight for it, not fight against it, but to fight for it.
I've been thinking of this Raymond Williams quote, to be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. I find it difficult to grapple with right now, but in your work, you talk about imagining. You talk about what if Reconstruction
Yes.
had actually honored the citizenship of 4 million freed people? What if Brown versus Board of Education were really honored? Being able to imagine, to envision, that's the way to get to hope. That's the only way, isn't it?
Yes, because it is in that imagining that you know what you're fighting for, that you don't look around you and say, well, this is the way it is, and so it's not going to get any better. It is in that imagining. I think about the enslaved. They had to imagine what freedom looked like. Wow. Imagine hundreds of years of being enslaved, and you imagine freedom, and that freedom is a possibility for you and your family, for those who look like you. That's powerful. It is those who came under Jim Crow who imagined what a system looked like that did not have Jim Crow as its operating principle. We have to have that power of imagination now. It looks really, really bad. But when we imagine what our future could be and what our present could be, and we organize and we mobilize, we vote for that future. Wow. Wow.
Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. You can find her important article, White Supremacists Declare War on Democracy and Walk Away Unscathed, on TheGuardian.com. Thank you so much for joining us this week, Carol Anderson.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network or to subscribe to our newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
sorry now. Whose heart is aching for breaking each vow? Who's sad and blue? Who's crying too? Just like I cried over you. Right to the end, just like a friend, I tried to warn you somehow. You had your way, now you must pay. I'm glad that you're sorry now.
Oh.
minutes, John Grant. That was a medley of hits from the Internet Archive, Roaring 20s music in the public domain. That last one was, I think, Count Basie, Shake That Thing, I think. May not have been Count Basie. Anyhow, all available for free downloads at the Internet Archive, also known as archive.org, in the public domain. And here's a classic blues also from there. But she's wild about that thing. Bessie Smith, 1929. Yes, we have it. We have John Grant reading from the New York Times and detailing the latest crimes of U.S. imperialism. And who knows what else? I mean, it's all from the New York Times and John Grant, mind. John Grant, are you alive?
Hello. Good morning.
Are you there?
Or good afternoon. I'm sorry. I'm a little slow there.
Well, you know, you're on the East Coast.
That's right. On the East Coast, it plains at all.
Sun comes up there too early for us.
Yeah, right. We get it ahead of you. We got an early view. You guys got to wait a little bit. Yeah.
So, quickly, the weather here the last 2 days has been in a balmy 70 degree.
Oh, God. Wow.
Yeah, really nice.
Oh,
about 48.
Well, I hope 40, that's blowing this way. God, yeah. Because we're cold here.
Yeah.
You know, we've almost got our long johns on here. It's down to, you know, I guess the mid-high 30s. I don't think it may have dipped before freezing for a while there at night, but you're on the cusp.
Oh, that's the daytime.
Yeah.
Daytime high. You're talking daytime high.
Yeah, it was
high.
Like 38 here yesterday, I know.
We don't had a couple days like that yet. Now, there's supposed to be some clipper coming down. Supposed to hit you guys, too, eventually.
Yeah,
and,
well, weather seems to come from you guys to us. That's that sort of basic direction. Yeah. For some reason, I'm not sure why. But
so by next Tuesday on This Can't Be Happening Radio, we'll probably both having our asses freezing out by that time.
Our butts off here, yeah. Yeah. Well.
So we were
coming.
In the green room. Or,
listeners,
we were, by the way, trolls, those of you who call in 111111111, I'm probably not. I mean, I'll screen your call. I'll put you in the green room if you want to talk. But I've had some bad experiences with trolls. You know, if you call in, you see them up front, you know, and everything, I'll put you on. But, you know, we do this 7 days a week, most of the time, 6 days for sure. And we've been getting a lot of trolls calling in on our show. So I'm screening
you. Well,
trolls
always make me feel like a fish. You know, I used to troll for Jacks and fish in the Keys, you know. That's my
image.
These
are hairy things.
They run through the water with an attractive lure, and I'm supposed to reach up and bite it. Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah,
the trolls today they're hairy. They live in caves, and they none of them have any real names. They just go
avatar
around
names.
And,
yeah, like.
They come out of a cave with a torch and they try to set your show on fire. That's what they do. They try to ruin your show.
Okay.
That's what trolls do. They want to distract you, get you off your subject,
right,
and make you incoherent and a mumbling idiot on air.
How do you set up a bomb to make somebody sound like an idiot? Yeah.
I will not play their games, you know, anymore. I'm pretty fed up.
But that said, you know, we would be delighted to have calls, even critical calls that, you know, think we're full of it. You know, and be civil and thoughtful and, you know.
I monitor the switchboard every week, every day, and I will tell you, John, there has been a couple trolls who called in. I think he was some sort of veteran for peace kind of guy.
Really?
Out in Arizona. It was months and months ago. And
yeah,
he was just listening. I think we have a couple that are not trolls. They just call in. Because you could call in the show off your computer in your home. And, you know, usually, if you use Skype or VoIP, it comes across as 111. So,
we're we're delighted to get calls from people who are engaged with the unfolding realities of our world, you know. I mean, we'd love to talk about
it. How well. Oh, that was really well put. I could not have
said well, I feel quite eloquent this morning, this afternoon, you know.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, earlier in the morning, you know, we have this little call listeners where I talk to John, or John calls me. Usually John calls me and wakes me up.
One or the
and,
other. I think you wake me up.
I don't think I've ever caught you off guard, ever. That's where it pisses me off. So I might try
a little later here. I usually, But, you know, if I sometimes, like last night, I went to bed at 3 a.m., so... you know, I usually sleep in a little, you know, 10 o'clock maybe or something. I mean, I don't have any cows to milk at dawn or anything like that.
No, I don't either. Thank God. I got 10 cats, 2 dogs. 10 cats, 2 dogs, and 2 horses.
And you don't have
to
milk those animals, so it's all right. Our cat usually wakes us up. He's a pain in the ass. About 6:30, he decides, you know, he wants to go out. It's light, you know, and we lock him in at night for the fox because the fox ate him, tried to eat him one night.
Oh, they will.
It took a bite out of his ass, and I didn't find it till the morning when he bled all over the bed, you know, when he came in.
Oh,
but,
man. He'll eat it.
So, he wants to get out about 6:30, and he's not shy. He will come in and howl, and get your fucking worthless asses up. You know, that's our cat. You know.
He'll howl.
It's like, wake up, you biped jerks over there. Come on. Luann, my wife, calls it our pride. Me and her and the cat, Charlie, is our pride.
Isn't that nice? We live on a highway or beside a highway, and in rush hour traffic, we've lost many dogs and a few cats.
Oh, yeah.
So my dearly beloved, she built what she calls a cat patio on a wraparound porch.
Right.
And
she
can get up and let them out through the cat door, and they'll go out to the cat patio, which is
I got a cat door, too.
She's lost enough pets that she's not going to let another pet die out on the highway. So
fair enough. Yeah.
So she's enclosed this thing, and it's turned into an obsession. I mean,
cat
rails, there's a hammock they can lay in, and they play
all
day.
A little cat
it's
circus.
Cat circus. Yeah, it's not little either. It's pretty big. And I was like, get the goddamn things out of here. I don't give a shit. Just get them out of the house. But you know,
so
I'm
sorry. You have a wraparound porch. What does that cover? What, 3 sides of your house or something or what?
It covers the highway side and the driveway side, so it's 2 sides.
I love porches. Like in Florida, they used to call them cracker houses that were, you know, made out of wood, 2-story, and they had porches on went all around the house. You had a porch all
around.
Yeah, it was really cool. But anyway.
That's okay. So we're supposed to... We're supposed to discuss news because John Grant has a hard copy subscription to the New York Times.
Right.
And I keep – I know that. Hard copy papers are
–
I love them. I really love them. My mother-in-law sends me the Kansas City Star hard copy, $180 a year. God damn. And and it's the last daily in this corner of the state. No shit, the last daily in this corner of the whole state of Kansas.
Right.
And so I value them. I keep them for weeks and months. And keep a couple. Take them and throw them.
We have piles all around the house of New York Times. Eventually, we get it fed up and throw them all in the recycle and start over again. You know.
Oh, yeah. Because
you can't read the whole damn paper. I mean, it's like, well, I'll save that. I'll read that time. Well, you have a stack that's 3 feet high. You're not going to read. So, okay, I'll move on and throw it all away.
We burn ours. In the dead of winter, when we run out of firewood, oh, God, we keep warm by
burning. Absolutely. I can see why. Yeah.
Now, wait, this morning, John, this morning, you started out, you were reading a front page story about war crimes. I was really sort of excited because I did not know. Mm-hmm. Well, I lose track, and they don't tell us that well. Who were bombing and killing now? What?
Well, this was a 2019 raid in Syria. In which they were closing in on ISIS, and something called a special operations unit called Task Force 9, which sounds pretty ominous. It's not, of course, the worst movie ever made, Plan 9 from Outer Space. That's another thing, but anyway.
Task Force 9.
And it, on March 18, 2019, the Syrian town of Bahus, it let loose. Well, first they said a 500-pound bomb and two 2,000-pound bombs, which were aimed at personnel escaping. Then they revised it and said, oh, no, it wasn't 2,000-pound bombs against personnel trying to flee from our first bombing. It was three 500-pound bombs. Well, listen, I'm not sure I'm going to believe the military on this, because they've tried to slip this by us. And the New York Times, they had an investigation set up, and they were going to investigate it with this general, and it suddenly just sort of fell off the table, and they moved on, and this and that. And the New York Times dug it out and did a major story on it. And so now the Pentagon has decided to reopen its investigation that it let lapse. And it's now, even examining, they refer to the Task Force 9 as a shadowy special ops unit. Anyway, they're researching it. There was apparently 80 people killed. Mostly, or a lot of them civilians, and some people argue it's a war crime, but we don't truck in that sort of realm, of course. Anyway, that's in process, and the military will come up with some explanation, and we'll never hear about it again, of course, but. that's happening. But the most important news to me was on page 11, the story on page 11, which I hadn't got to when I talked to you first. But Honduras, my little beloved country of Honduras, the second greatest basket case after Haiti in the Western Hemisphere. Of course, a little country that was named by conquistadors Honduras, which means depth or ditch or, that sort of thing. It's not exactly, Spanish for shithole country, but it's sort of, reminiscent of that sort of reflection on a place. Honduras. And the example in the Spanish-English dictionary is meterse en Honduras, which means beyond your depth. One gets beyond one's depths, meterse en Honduras. So idea of Honduras is the idea of a depth, a deep spot. Anyway, that beside that, they just had an election on Sunday and is now leading by 20 percentage points over the candidate of the National Party, which, of course, is the party that was put into power after the 2009 coup, which, at dawn, the military crashed into the President Manuel Zelaya's office or palace or home or whatever, and in his pajamas woke him up and at gunpoint took him out of his palace and flew him out of the country. And then took off, and then, of course, the new government took off and was excused by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. You know, they all said, well, we'll work it out. You know, we'll figure this thing out. But they didn't oppose it. Anyway, after the coup, the murder rate in the Honduras just escalated incredibly and became a very murderous place. The drug dealers moved in at the same time that the U.S. drug enforcement military troops moved in with many little bases in Honduras. So the coup set off a whole dark, violent, reaction against the poor people of this poor, very, very poor country. Well, the wife of deposed President Manuel Zelaya now ran for president herself, and she is winning by 20 percentage points, which is amazing. And she is considered a socialist. She says, we will... and the person they threw out was Juan Orlando Hernandez, better known as J-O-H. And the cry of the election was, Joe, J-O-H, J-O-H, Joe, Joe, and away you go. So they got rid of Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was not very popular these days, very, very corrupt, led this corrupt post-coup situation. And now the people of Honduras, you know, and the idea of democracy on the ropes, right, in this little, quote, shithole country in Central America that the United States has sort of exploited and abused for decades and decades, the people of that little country decided to vote in... the deposed president's wife, a socialist. And so, this is a really, really interesting turn of events. And we will see what happens. We will see if the United States government, if Joe Biden, who, of course, was vice president when the coup went down in 2009. Oversaw the ushering in, analogous with, of course, the coup in 1960 or 54 in Guatemala, which ushered in decades of one of the most ruthless and bloody military governments in Central America or South America. And, of course, the coup in 2009, it wasn't quite like 54 in Guatemala, but... nevertheless, the United States almost took a Sergeant Schultz approach and says, we see nothing, all of a sudden Honduras went even farther down into the ditch, the depths of the dark side and killing and murder and all this kind of stuff, with the influx of the drug, because it's a drug point for transporting drugs. You hop, hip, scop, and a jump. You stop in Honduras, and then you move into the U.S. So it's a big, I think it's big, big news. Page 11, New York Times. Her name is Xiomara Castro. So it will be another President Castro in Central America. And
I'd vote for just for that.
Yeah, of course, right. And here, sure, go ahead. What?
That's the wife of this guy Zelaya, the guy that they kidnapped,
right?
And kicked out of
Manuel Zelaya, also known as Mel. He's known as Mel Zelaya, a wealthy Honduran landowner. He was deposed in late 2009. And now here, this is a bit of a slander here from Anatoly Kurmanayev and Joan Suazo.
Who's that?
Reporters. They're the reporters. Oh. The New York Times is usually terrible on these places. You know, they report the news, but then they always slip in like this paragraph here. Mel Zelaya, a wealthy Honduran landowner and former president who was deposed in a military coup in 2009, true. And here's the part that really flames me out.
Deposed.
After having tried to emulate the policies of Venezuela's president at the time, Hugo Chavez. No, that's a crock of horse shit. He was not trying to emulate Hugo Chavez. Yes, he's a leftist. Yes, he's a socialist, like Arbenz in 1954 in Guatemala, who was overthrown. You know, and they used the tactics they're using now in America with fake news and post-truth stuff and all that. Bamboozled the Guatemalan people and installed Castillo Armas, who, you know, again, established one of the bloodiest military institutions in Latin America that went into the northern mountains of Guatemala and literally slaughtered Mayan Indians by the thousands in the 70s and early 80s, thanks
and
to the United States coup. Thank you very much.
They're digging
bodies
up. There's mass graves being discovered all over fucking Central America. It's not even just Guatemala. I mean, they're doing it in El Salvador. They're doing it in I'm like going, Jesus Christ, these mass graves all over the goddamn place, you know? And it's like
I photographed some of them. I went to Morazan province and photographed El Masote, which is a famous massacre with the Aklacatl Brigade. And they took basically a lot of the people in the village, I don't know, like over 100 people, put them in the base of a church, or the basement of a church, and gunned them all down in the basement of the church, then blew up the church and burned it down. And I was there when, in this little church chapel with the Argentine forensic anthropologist, Dr. Snow, a famous international anthropologist, forensic anthropologist, and these Argentine women were, you know, they had grid marks and they were going through all these chunks of charred bone and you know, amazing sort of thing they were doing. And then they moved the bones to a morgue outside of San Salvador, which I visited and photographed and, you know, talked to the pathologist there who was going through. He would show me, lift up a bone, so this is a baby's jaw, you know, and you know, it was very profound thing for me to watch this, you know, trying to publicize and explain this massacre, ironically, of a very conservative village. It wasn't a communist or leftist or FMLN village at all. And for some reason, they just, you know, gunned everybody down. It's hard to explain why, but that's what happens in these wars. Anyway...
Well, the critical thing for me, and I think I've got to interrupt you because, you know, I think the critical thing is for us is to recognize that those are American bullets, American guns, probably made in America uniforms. I mean, it's, and definitely not just U.S. trained at
School of the Americas, the Aklacatl Brigade
was
trained in Benning, Columbus, Georgia.
But I'm going to emphasize this because it's local. At the U.S. War College in Leavenworth, Kansas, you can go up there if you get on the base. I mean, since 9/11, they've turned into a bunch of morally panicking idiots. So they, you get on the base and get through it's absolutely absurd what they've done to the base up there at Fort Leavenworth. But you can get up there and you can go to the museum or you can go to the War College and walk down the hallway and you can see all these goddamn – they put their pictures up, you know, on the wall. these generals, these guys that went to war college and later became generals all over the world, especially Central America.
Right.
And it's like, it's pretty, it's a wide, eye-opening experience, Kansas listeners. Go up there. They'll let you in. I mean, you're going to have to go through a security blank, but you can get up there, and you get to go to the U.S. War College and go through their they've got a museum, and then they've got a well, you'll just, these pictures are so numerous, they, at least when I went up there about 5 years ago, I mean, they're everywhere, these goddamn generals, these pictures of generals. And then, and they're not from the United States military. It's not like a picture of Patton or something. All these goddamn, a lot of them became dictators, you know, office holders. Hello, are you still there?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, they became presidents of so-and-so, quote, shithole, unquote, country.
Well, the guy who started the School of the Americas Watch, excuse me, Roy Bourgeois, a Vietnam veteran, Mary Noel Priest, a good friend of mine, actually, he started the School of the Americas Watch. He lives right at the base, an apartment right at the gate at Fort Benning. And we used to do that. I did that for 15 years. I would go down there every year to demonstration. He was famous for, I think it was, it may have been when the Atlacottle Brigade was being trained in the Fort Benning School of America.
Yeah.
He and another fellow, they went to the, you know, there's military clothing stores all over the around Fort Benning, Columbus. And he went and he got a uniform for a full bird colonel. And he wore the uniform of a full bird colonel, came on base, they let him on base, climbed up into a tree outside of the barracks where the Salvadoran Atlacottle Brigade was housed, and played a boombox, which he chained to the tree with himself, and he played a boombox recording of Archbishop Romero's call to the poor people of El Salvador to not to, in the military, that are shanghaied and drafted into the military, not to kill their brothers and sisters, right? Profound speech, Archbishop Romero, again, a conservative priest that they thought, oh, this bookish guy will be great, you know. But it turned out he actually had a huge moral compass, you know, conscience. And so they ended up, of course, killing him. And this was a speech he gave directed at the soldiers, the low-ranking soldiers in the Salvadoran military, to stop the killing of your own people. And, of course, they then murdered him in a chapel as he was giving some nuns, you know, a mass. The door was open. I've been to that chapel. The door was wide open, and somebody came, drove by, and they had a rifle and shot him right through the door and got him in the heart. And as he was
giving
him, oh, yeah, yeah. They had the bloody vestments and everything there, you know. And, of course, you know, this was Roy played this speech to the Salvadoran soldiers in their barracks. And, of course, he did, they arrested him, and he did, I think it was 2 years in prison for that. I mean, they didn't kid around. They gave him 2 years. But that's Roy Bourgeois, who's now been excommunicated from the Catholic Church because he worked with and advocated some women who were mobilizing to, you know, become priests in the Catholic Church. And, of course, that is verboten, so they threw him out of the church. That's the history of Roy Bourgeois.
You would think today's Pope Frankie,
yeah.
Francis,
right.
Would say, well, man,
Frank is a good man, but he's a company man. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. They're always out there. Have you noticed that? every fucking organization has a fucking company man. I run into them now. Democrats, you know, who just are
sure. Well, I mean,
really
nobody
understanding.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. I ran into my former opponent.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Republican, and he's
okay.
playing the moderate thing now. I'm very, you know, I'm like, oh, my God.
Interesting.
They're so slick. I mean, the newspapers. Finally,
uh-huh.
an article about him, and I thought this is what we're up against. These people
right.
who said, well, you know, I'm for medical marijuana. I don't want to get off on this very long, but I'm for medical
right.
marijuana, but I want a doctor to administer it and to prescribe it and to give it
mm-hmm.
to the patients. And I'm like going, holy shit, you know, this is over weed, you know.
right.
I'm for expanding medical care to Medicaid, but you know, he's got all these little conditions. I mean, you could tell he's a goddamn lawmaker, and you know, and I don't think there's a big move. You have to become a lawyer to become an elected official now.
Right. Well, that's why there's so many damn many lawyers in there.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if these people in that you were talking about in Honduras
mm-hmm.
or
yeah.
El Salvador, because I heard that El Salvador's got some real weirdo new president who wants to turn the currency into some bit currency.
Yeah. We've talked about him. He's a kind of a rogue down there. He has like an Arab name almost, but it's apparently he's trying to work himself into this authoritarian role, but he's been pretty popular, I guess. I haven't followed him that much, but I think I may have mentioned this, but in 2010 I went to the inauguration of the first FMLN president, you know, the former guerrilla unit.
In El Salvador,
Mauricio Funes.
Okay.
I went down there. I went to his inauguration party and got drunk on rum and cokes and had a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was dancing and it was great. I mean, the FLN was now the president, had a president in the office. Well, of course, I don't know whether it was a good charge or not. It may not have been. They put Lulu in jail in Brazil, of course. But anyway, he ended up going to jail, which was not a good thing. But then they elected another FMLN fella, and I don't know what happened to him exactly. And then now they have elected this fella with whose name I can't think of, who is not connected to either the far right Arena party or the far left FMLN former guerrilla party. He has some new other third party. So I don't know exactly what's going on there with him in El Salvador. All I know is that this is really good news in Honduras, but it's also something that people should be very, very wary of, because as we know, the track record, the far right is capable of anything. And especially with the United States saying, I see nothing, what's going to come next? So I think I'm going to write letters to my congressman, saying, Ms. Castro should be supported. We owe them that after we screwed them on, the Obama, Biden administration, Clinton administration. Screwed poor little Honduras in 2009 by not standing up and saying, we will not condone, we will not accept, and we will not support this coup government that took over a duly democratic elected president of Honduras. The same with President Orban's in Guatemala in 1954. Duly elected democratically elected president, which we tossed out. Anyway,
well, the United Nations condemned this action against Zelaya also, didn't they? I think
right.
They,
I'm pretty sure.
Body,
yeah. I mean, it was a no-brainer in my view. I mean, you know, you break into a president's house and at gunpoint move him out. I think that should be frowned upon. That's illegal, you know.
Well, no,
if you are a country
that
supports democracy, you know.
The United Nations is doing this. I get so fed up with Americans because they just are glib about the United Nations. But they don't want to pay attention to it. It's like they don't want to pay attention to wars until their son comes back in a box.
The UN is
black
helicopters.
Yeah, I know it's a nest of spies and espionage, but big deal. Their votes are public. They're on TV. You can look at them and see what they're saying and figure it out yourself. It's sort of like reading the New York Times, if you ask me. But it's still. But you better pay attention to the United Nations because it tells you if 185 motherfucking countries representatives don't like you, you might consider changing your way. I mean, and I think the UN said something about that Honduras crap, despite that fucking Security Council, the U.S. being on it, you know, which would, I guess, controls everything.
Absolutely.
You
talk about corruption. I mean, there is certainly the UN is rife with corruption. I mean, because the world and history is rife with corruption. Corruption is like oxygen. You know, it's like I look at corruption like good and evil, like when you're the doctor slaps you on the ass to get that first breath. You know, from that moment on, it's a struggle between good and evil and, you know, all that sort of thing. Decency, dignity, and corruption. And, of course, you're living and dying at every moment, you know, as you approach, go from birth to death. That's my quick philosophy of life, you know.
Here we go with Buddha. Buddha, John Grant, giving us this moment of meditative thought.
My reflections on life.
Well, you've seen all these bones of these U.S. armed, killed killers. These grotesque bones and stuff. You know, I can see why you would put page 11 of today's New York Times and go to the front and cover over yet a clear-cut example of American U.S. Army investigating a war crime committed in Syria.
Absolutely.
That was the Army. Yeah. That's the Army investigating the Army, by the way, folks.
Well, yeah, and of course, thanks to the New York Times, it was resurrected because when the Army was investigating the Army, you know, they established this investigation, had a general in charge of it, and then all of a sudden, it just decided to find itself in some file in some drawer and was left there, and nobody did anything about it until the New York Times says, hey, what the fuck are you doing? You know, this happened and splashed it all over the page so everybody could see it. And then they said, uh-oh, I guess we better reestablish that. Well, this is the history of American imperialism, of course. I mean, I could go on and on, but...
Well, let's look at more. This is bureaucracy at its best.
Right, at its best, I guess. Worst or best, I'm not sure which. But
I mean, we are supposed to be doing this. Can't be happening at thiscan'tbehappening.net. You know, every once in a while, we got to include that. But I mean,
well, there you go.
We should be reminded. Yeah. Can't be happening. And Dave Lindorf wrote an article, very prescient article that got a lot of legs and didn't get him shit. I mean, he might have got, I think he got paid a little bit from The Nation magazine.
Oh, okay.
But he got paid from The Nation, but it was a front cover article. And I'll dig it up. But by God, it's an article about how, you know, Lindorf is, Lindorf lampooned some, but he's not as good as you are, John.
I'm not in competition with Dave. Yeah.
Well, I know, but I mean, you know, when it comes to humor, Lindorf has a sense of humor that you got to.
Well, humor
sort of
is—it's either—it's either, you know. I mean, if you want to survive in life, you better have a sense of humor.
He's
or,
not as
you know.
He's not as balderdash or whatever you and I. But I will tell you this: article. This was a real a good article because it was about the auditing the Pentagon, and they couldn't.
Yeah, I remember that.
They spent
millions
in
the nation on the military. Absolutely, yeah.
They hired hundreds of accountants, spent millions of dollars,
right.
and years trying to figure out where the money went in the Pentagon, and it failed. It failed.
Right. Right.
It failed, listeners, and that was several years ago, wasn't it, John?
About a year ago, I guess, and, you know, I don't know, it was all
it
part of that $600 toilet seats and all the things that the military did.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unbelievable the fucking money is thrown away.
Well, you
Donnie
know, you can
Trump
see
didn't...
how this happens. I was, as a reporter once, I was doing a story on these three young people who were designers that just set up a designing company, right? And I'm talking to one of these guys, you know, he's a young kid, he's mid-20s or something, and he's telling me about how he designed this switch for a government military contract, right? And they wanted the switch designed so that they could ask a lot of money for it. So he had the design. He designed it so that it looked really, really complicated and cool, you know. So they could charge, you know, $150 for it, versus a little on-off switch that would have accomplished the same thing, toggle switch, but you know they would have had to sell for $398. You know what I mean? You know, so there's a lot of that goes on. I mean, you design things with the plastic and all that makes it so you can up the price. And before you know it, you get a $600 toilet seat. You know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, must be nice. You know, I don't know. You know?
Well, there's no bureaucracy at thisCan'tBeHappening.net.
No,
you,
it's,
no bureaucracy.
No, there's no bureaucracy there. We're just floundering like every other marginalized leftist writer in America,
or for that matter, radio show.
Radio shows, marginalized radio shows.
The only thing you can, at least I get occasionally obscene. I get obscene. That's what I got on thisCan'tBeHappening.net.
Really?
So, yeah, that's the only thing I have not yet to read a big long string of obscenities at the website.
Right. Yeah, I was reading about the exchange with the Congresswoman Bohert from Colorado.
Oh,
she's the little petite beauty that loves to strap on guns, and she owns a restaurant in which all her waiters pack heat. They carry guns. And she was
even the waitress.
Yeah, the I don't know about the waitress.
Even the waitress.
Well, okay. Well, hell, of course. You never know when somebody's gonna, you know, get upset that your soup was a little cold and open fire on you. Defend them, you know. But anyway, she took off after Congressman Ilhan.
John, let's finish the stick on Boebert. The bar and grill is located in where? Rifle, Colorado.
Oh, Rifle, of course, right.
Okay, there we go. All right.
Well,
yeah,
that's out in cowboy country. You know, I mean, you're out in cowboy country. You know, I mean, Dodge City, Kansas,
no,
and all that stuff.
No, I'm out here in hog feed. I'm out here in hog feed and cattle.
Well, you're in the northeast corner, of course, right?
Yeah,
I guess Dodge City's out to the west, right?
Yeah, well, you're a big fan of bullshit. You drive by out here, you see bulls for sale. Matter of fact, my former opponent, my Republican opponent in the state legislature, that's what he does. He's a bull breeder. He's a bull breeder. And
a
that's
bull
what
breeder.
They do.
Well, what is
bull
what
breeder.
Is he what signs out his bull to go into the pasture and inseminate little Bessie or what? What is he?
Yeah.
Or does he do it himself? You know, some of these guys.
It's worse than that.
I pity his stuff is like you really can't talk about it in mixed crowds because it's pretty grotesque.
I pity his wife because he sells the semen. He sells the throw. He sells the jizz. He sells the cum. You know?
Well, you know, here's one. There's a TV show of some strapping fellow, I forget his name, who goes and, you know, spends a while and does these very difficult, messy jobs, right? And they do a shit on it, do a show on it. And one of the jobs he did was jacking off bulls. Now, apparently, that's a very delicate operation.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, they
the bull will kill you if you do it wrong.
Right.
The bull will kill you if you do it wrong.
Oh, God.
Talking about a fucking patriarchy. Yeah, it's a fucking patriarchy.
Well, but apparently, you know, and this guy has a sense of humor, so it was a very funny show as he's trying to milk this bull, you know. It's like, anyway, it was amusing.
Well, so we're not really Western Kansas gun country. Well, I mean,
no,
everybody's got guns, but...
You're more like,
Eastern
Kansas. I guess that's...
Yeah, you see some... Every once in a while, you'll see some fucking crazy cracker with a fucking camouflage outfit and a big Bowie knife and a hip hip holster. And he'll come into the Petro Pantry and gas up his 4x4 and stand around and look at all of us, and we're all looking like... Is he about to kill all of us, or what? Is he going to kill all of us?
Mike. Wait. Do you really have a place called the Petrol Pantry?
Petrol Pantry. That's the name of it. It's an
Petrol
business.
Pantry. It's like what? Here we have the Wawas. You don't have any Wawas out
No. Never heard of it? Wouldn't allow it.
Well, there's
7-Eleven.
But in Pennsylvania, for some reason, we have Wawas. And it's in the language. Yeah, I got to go to the Wawa to get a pack of cigarettes.
How do you spell that? I mean, how does it spell?
W-A-W-A, Wawa. I don't know. I can just imagine the guy who's starting the business. He looks at his son, who's like 18 months old, and he said, "What should we call it?" Wawa. Oh, okay, we'll call it Wawa.
And it's a chain? It's not just one store?
There's Wawa. It's like 7-Elevens. You have 7-Elevens, right?
We have 7-Elevens and Quick.
The Minute Mart type thing. The Wawa is our Minute Mart.
Yeah.
Like your petrol pantries, you know.
Petrol pantry, yeah.
Petrol.
There's only one of them. By the way, there's only one of these that I know of. Now, they all go by. No, it's not. There's another company called Casey. That's a fucking weird name, dude.
I always thought so, but now it's. I've known about it for 50 years, so it's like it's in the language. You know, it's like Wawa. Hey, I got to go to the Wawa. You what?
Well, you don't see guys walk around with AR-15s all armed up, playing costumes.
No, not here. No, we're civilized here in southeast Pennsylvania. You know, we're.
Well, we would like, I have to speak for even my former opponent. We would like to think we're civilized here, too. Because we do, but every once in a while we get the crazies come around. They're around. They're out here. But they're not dominant. They're not like, it's not Rifle Colorado.
No.
What did she do? She insulted the
Ilhan. I forget her first name, but Congresswoman Ilhan, the Somali refugee, who is she's a legitimate, serious, good congresswoman. And, of course, Bo Hert, they're both rather diminutive, small, pert little women.
Yeah.
Both of them very attractive. But somehow Bo Hert had, I forgot how she insulted her. She was telling a crowd of people in Colorado that she found herself in an elevator with Congresswoman Bohert, and that she had been advised, be careful, don't go on an elevator, Erhan's in there. And she said, well, Christ, I can take her on, you know. And so she steps into the elevator. And she said, besides, I noticed she wasn't carrying a backpack, so it was safe.
The crowd responded.
Yeah, that she was somehow didn't have a bomb strapped on her, so it was okay.
and
of course, Ilhan got all pissed off and said, this is outrageous. And then Bo Hert calls her up and makes some feeble effort to apologize. And then, says, I'm sorry, but you're a terrorist bitch, you know, or something. That was kind of apology, I guess it was. And so Ilhan hung up on her, very famously hung up on her. And Bo Hert suggested that made it very clear that she was a terrorist.
I thought
you can't laugh at this stuff. I mean, you know, running around screaming into the night. So I choose to laugh. You know,
you got Groper and Roper, the other guy. Hot news! What was it? Steve Bannon is he's been indicted since we visited. He's been
indicted,
court.
And this guy Clark, you know this Zero Clark. He was the mailroom clerk or something over at Justice. I don't know what he was, but they were looking. Trump was looking for somebody to take over, the Justice Department, that would do his bidding. And this guy said, "Here I am. I'm ready to do whatever you want."
Yes.
You know, and and of course. They want him now to testify on the January 6th hearings, and of course he is not doing so. He says he has the right because of privileges, because he was involved with the president, so he's now going to be charged with contempt and hopefully put away in jail soon enough, sooner than later. They need to start putting guys in jail now. And my wife, Louise, in the other room. Yes.
Well, the shaman, the QAnon shaman. He's down 41 months.
They gave him 41 months or something like that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the number. Yeah.
And he was a symbol, and they should give him that much. Absolutely.
Well. Yeah. I mean, I think that, frankly, they should turn them into janitors. I mean, and make them clean up shit and piss.
That's fair.
I honestly think that they're that low, and I don't think that's that as
occupied Senator Santorum's office during the Iraq War, they made me do public service like that. For 3 days, I had to wear a orange jumpsuit and pick up trash in West Philadelphia on this 3 or 4 block. And my job was to, with my buddy Tom.
In orange?
We had orange, anchor orange. And, we had to wear these. So we were inmates on the street for the day. And, we picked up trash and glass and cigarette butts and whatnot. And my buddy Tom, who was an academic and taught Russian and Russian literature at Swarthmore University, he's now dead,
yeah.
But Tom and I did it together, and Tom, he had me take a really cool picture of himself cleaning up, you know, in his orange jumpsuit, and it reminded him of Ivan Klima. Ivan Klima is, I think, a Czechoslovakian novelist. See,
oh.
Tom knew all these guys. He knew all these guys. Anyway, he read Ivan Klima's novel Love and Garbage, in which the character is assigned to do exactly that with a yellow jumpsuit. He had a yellow jumpsuit. And he had to clean up trash in Prague or someplace like that. And that was all part of the drama in this novel, Love and Garbage. So Tom was like, he's beside himself. Oh, you got to take a really cool picture of me. So I took a picture of him, and he sent it to all his friends and his daughters and said, here I am, like right out of Ivan Klima, you know.
Doing public penance.
Public penance for occupying Senator Rick Santorum's office. And
that's not bad punishment, really. I mean, I tell you, it's a lot. That sounds a lot better than working a year in a bowling alley in Lemon Grove, California, for $2.25 an hour.
Who did
doing,
that?
Doing the same thing. I felt that was fun.
Who, somebody was doing penance in the bowling alley? Who was that? The Big Lebowski, or who are we talking?
For several Saturday mornings, I'd go in there and find out that the local neighborhood juvenile delinquents had once again shit in the goddamn men's lavatory.
Oh, my.
That's the price you pay for being a janitor. That's why I say I think these guys, like Steve Bannon, I would relish today to go to Washington D.C. see Steve Bannon in an orange jumpsuit and piss on the floor and tell him to mop it up. You know, that's what I say. Get out there and mop it up. I mean, that's what I think. That's better than,
we don't want to make it easy on them.
We don't want to make it joyful either. I mean, we still like to do it, right. You know, and that's it. So, well, John, we're reaching the end of the hour, and it was an amazing trip. I noticed that we got some listeners. It was an amazing trip through the New York Times, and we went from mass graves to talking about getting Steve Bannon to mop up piss. I think we went.
I don't know. Yeah, we'd have to analyze how we got from A to B there. I don't know.
I think it's I think it's been a good show, listeners. John Grant will be back
always
next
good
Tuesday.
To talk with you,
and
Mike.
Don't wait. Go to thiscan'tbehappening.net and check out some of the goddamn articles these guys write. They're damn good.
Well, I haven't written anything for quite a while. I've had some sort of, block going on here. I'm not sure what's going on, but I'm going to start writing again. Yeah,
don't let your cat get in the way. All right?
No, Charlie.
All right.
I hear a phone. All right. See you later, Mike.
Wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing. Are you?